welcome to Future Imperfect. I'm your host, Admiral Phillips, and joining me in this endeavor into the stars is Alex and Aaron Pollier.
Hello, hello.
Hi there. Oh, we both talk at the same time. Hi, everybody.
And this week, unfortunately, he got sucked into a black hole somewhere, is Mike the Birdman Dodd. He'll be back next week, though, because we'll send a probe to find him. This week, we're covering The Orville. So some of us have seen it as it's progressed, and some of us had the fortunate ability to blitz it all at once and get all of the stories instead of having to watch the trickle down from cable television. So I guess without further ado, let me get into the description of the show. And it's an American sci-fi comedy drama written, created, starring Seth MacFarlane as the Captain Ed Mercer of the Planetary Union, which is basically United Federation of Planets, in the 25th century, which, again, they went to the 25th century before Trek even broke out of the 24th. And it's heavily inspired by the original Star Trek as well as The Next Generation. And fortunately enough, we have many, many Star Trek cast and crew who continue to either show up as guest stars or directors or writers, producers on this program. So what are your guys' thoughts on it just from the get-go?
You want me to go first then?
Sure. Yeah.
When I saw the preview for it, I was like, oh, comedy Star Trek. Like right away, I was like, is it going to be pure comedy? Even before seeing it. And I thought, I'll give it a go. The special effects look good. I had heard that Seth MacFarlane was like a huge, huge Trekkie and had for years sort of wanted to do something with it, but his contract with Fox wouldn't allow. And I guess he finally got enough clout at Fox to go, I'm making my own Star Trek. And they said, okay, here's the check because you've made us ridiculous amounts of money for your cheap animation for years.
So true. I'll let Aaron go before I give my thoughts on it.
My general thoughts on the show. I liked it a lot and disliked it just a tiny bit, but for weird reasons. That's my overall summary. When I first saw the trailers for it, I was like, oh, great. You know, great. A comedy Star Trek. They're going to be making fun of it, or the comedy's going to be silly. And I'd say that as I watched it on its first run on television, I think I was kind of justified in my thought about the comedy being a little silly. But the show wasn't making fun of Star Trek by any means. So I don't know. My general opinion is a big thumbs up.
See, when I first saw the notifications that it was coming, is I was like, oh, great, it's a Seth MacFarlane show. And I was considering, you know, Family Guy and American Dad and all these other animated series, which were kind of lowbrow, funny, but lowbrow. And I was like, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I'm going to watch it just because it kind of gave me that vibe of Star Trek and Galaxy Quest. And being that I was a fan of pretty much any of the space travel and this type of genre of sci-fi, I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And I saw Fox was doing it, which I was a little leery of because typically Fox programs don't last long, whether they're good or not. And so I was a little apprehensive of jumping on board. But once I did, I was quite happy with the result that they came up with through the characters. I would say the first 2 to 3 episodes are a little rough because it feels very Family Guy-esque. Beyond that, it actually grows itself out rather nicely into that episodic television that we got with the original Star Trek and The Next Generation.
So maybe I should go into like a little more detail on my likes and dislikes of the series overall. I'd say like season one is okay. The comedy was pretty grating in the first few episodes, but it continually got better. And I can say for certain that none of the episodes really stood out to me as being like teeth grinding or anything like that. My only complaint with the series in season one and two overall was that, yeah, the comedy could be a little amateurish at times or forced, but it was mainly that it was in an uncanny valley with Star Trek. And my love of Star Trek was so high that it felt weird watching it. And then later on, that kind of morphed in season two into being more of like a sick feeling. And this sounds awful, but like feeling a little sick that this isn't Star Trek, because this is doing such a great job compared to Star Trek Discovery or Star Trek Picard in actually being Star Trek. And that's a compliment. I'm complimenting the show, but it still made me feel weird. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely relate to that, because you can tell it's been inspired heavily by Star Trek, and Seth MacFarlane is an uber fan of it, considering he was also in Enterprise, albeit yeah. briefly. And he shot that short film when he was in high school, pretending that they were on the Enterprise and going through a black hole. There's like a short clip of it floating around on YouTube somewhere, but yeah, I mean, it's so good that it deserves to be among the Star Trek lineup, but obviously for other reasons, it can't be. I would have loved to have seen what Seth MacFarlane could have done with Star Trek had he been given the reins instead of what we got.
Oh, I would have loved it too. Absolutely loved to see that.
So what are some of the standout episodes that you honestly thought were almost Star Trek worthy in what they brought to the table and what the thoughts that were provoked while watching it?
I can name a few. Well, I'd say most of my standout episodes are also in season two, and standout in both ways. Like, there's an episode that really ticked me off in season two, but like there's episodes that are great. And I think Primal Urges, where there's the planet being torn apart by its star, while yeah, the science is utter garbage in it, it feels very Star Trek, and I was down with it. I was engaged in it because I actually really liked the storyline going on. I really liked it. I also loved I love all the episodes that basically dealt with Isaac and Claire developing their relationship. Mm-hmm. Well, I saw a lot of parallels with what happened with Data. I thought they were taking it in a really interesting direction, and then leading into the two-part mid-season episodes where it turns out Isaac's species is basically the evil bad guys and they're wanting to kill all biological life. Fantastic. Very Star Trek, and well worth watching.
Yeah, I totally agree on those points too. There were a few episodes that also kind of stood out to me, and one of them was in I want to say season one, maybe might have it wrong. No, it's in season one, Majority Rule, the episode where they're heading to a culture similar to 21st century Earth looking for two anthropologists, and Lamar is arrested for doing the inappropriate public behavior. And that's where they have the voting, the upvote, downvote. And then they basically lobotomize everybody. And it kind of, it's very reminiscent of Twitter, which is, I think, the inspiration for this, because the more you do something that people deem not okay, the more it spreads like wildfire, and everybody's like, look at this dick, you know, blah blah blah, you know, and it just creates this false, even if it wasn't meant with malice, like it's like those tweets that come back 10 years ago and come back and bite you now. It's the same kind of messaging with the way that they do the voting in this. And so I thought it was really interesting that they tackled that in that way. And then in season two, I liked the, the lasting impressions one where they have the time capsule.
Oh God, where they dig it up. That was
such a great episode. It kind of reminded me of something that you would probably see in like Voyager. Because they had a lot of stuff where it would kind of touch on things from the past, or even TNG had some episodes like that, you know, with finding the cryo frozen individuals that got brought on the Enterprise or the old space shuttle. So it was kind of funny seeing this time capsule from 2015, and then they're looking at the cell phone like, what's this, you know? And Gordon, of course, uploads it to the ship's computer and has a simulation and starts having like this almost Barclay like life in the simulator, you know, the holodeck basically. And it was really interesting watching that play out. You know, albeit there were some humorous elements to it, but it felt very Star Trek in that.
It felt very real in some ways. And that was the only episode that I can actually say I had a little tear in my eye.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was, I don't know, for whatever reason, him connecting with somebody that he actually never really knew, couldn't really ever be with, except through, you know, the simulation, and still somehow developing this relationship with her and who she was and having this weird connection to the past. I don't know. It hit me in the feels. And I had a tear in my eye. I'm not ashamed to say it. It was a really good episode.
It almost felt like it, the closest thing to that, the emotions it brings up, were watching that short trek recently. Was it Calypso? That's the one where it shows the relationship building between the stranded guy and the ship's AI.
Yeah.
Similar feel. I'm like, why couldn't Star Trek be like this? Watching it, I went, yeah, you're right. It feels probably most like a Voyager episode, or an episode
from season two of TNG.
Yeah, that exactly, something like that. Thinking about other episodes in particular, I liked a lot of elements of different episodes, mm-hmm. but you guys have touched on the ones that are probably the strongest. They have some decent B plot lines. I will say one thing. Fox did the standard thing Fox usually does, and they aired some of the episodes out of order. I can't remember if it was season one or season two, but they introduced a character before they were supposed to be introduced.
I think it was season two, because they had the other character replace Alara.
Yeah, but it wasn't just that. Oh, it was the character, the sleeper Krill agent that was on the crew,
mm.
that was disguised as a human. She's in the first episode of season two, but she doesn't get introduced to like episode three. Something like that. Let me look here. Not to mention, actually, there's more stuff here. Looking at the production codes is a telltale sign too. A couple episodes from season two were actually produced for season one.
Yeah, Primal Urges was season one.
Yeah. So, yeah. they did the same Fox thing.
Now, the benefit of this now is that they're on Hulu, so they can kind of do whatever they want.
Yeah, and I believe they've been put in the correct order there.
Yeah.
And for the
it is on the correct order there. Because I rewatched them in order a while ago, and the nice thing about them going to Hulu instead of being on Fox is not only do they not have to conform to the 38 to 42 minute time span for cable purposes, but they're also able to have more freedom with it. The quote from the show was saying that Hulu allows them more freedom. Seth runs the show. We take the ideas where it takes us, talk about the show and write it how we write it and produce it. And this is what Hulu allows us is once it's produced, we don't have to be worried about length. So there will be a variety of lengths. It allows us to have some stuff in that we would have had to cut if we were on a network.
I just hope they don't use this as an excuse to start swearing. We get enough of that in Discovery.
In Star Trek.
Yeah. So
both of them, actually.
Like, yeah, there's plenty there that's not needed. Other people might be afraid, like, oh, he's gonna, you know, delve into his Family Guy asking. No. It's quite clear the vision he wanted for the show. I just get this feeling that season one had a lot of the Family Guy style humor put in because Fox wanted it, or that's how he sold it to Fox. You know, he always wanted to make a hardcore Star Trek show, and they're like, well, you're the funny man. You know, our audience doesn't care about the brain. They only care about laughing.
Which is why some of the episodes, although they might have a lot of the brain and the heart of Star Trek in them, they'll have some of those funny moments, you know, like in the Lasting Impressions episode, which Seth MacFarlane wrote. He has the Mocklins where they have a nicotine addiction, and then they all start chain smoking.
That's a great episode. That's actually one of the few where the comedy actually works quite well, where they're hiding the smokes from each other.
I loved that episode too. I thought that was really good humor. And most of the time, the humor in the show, unless it's dry, the dry humor when it's kind of like a little more upfront, I normally am not a, I won't say I hate it, but I'm not a fan of it. But that was really well done.
We discussed a little off air before we started the computer virus from porn episode, and you get a snicker. You're like, that's kind of a, they came up with that obviously at like a round table, what would be a funny episode. But I did laugh at, you know, the reaction when other people were going into the hologram being like, this is what your fantasy is. And like just the sheer amount of embarrassment on his end, it was kind of funny, but
I do not wish to speak of it.
Yes. I do not wish to speak of it.
I do not wish to speak of it.
And he's like, don't go in there. It's like, just don't go in there. They walk in, they're like, what the hell is going on? It's like, we're here to pleasure you. Okay, no thanks.
And it wasn't like it seemed like that would be very out of, you know, out of the ballpark for a simulation, let's be honest. To me, I was like, wow, that's out of the ordinary, really?
That's okay. What I mean. Like, it was kind of tame, but the whole idea was, the even though that was the joke, the core of it was about the breakdown of communication in a relationship. So they didn't just do it for the gag. It wasn't just a Family Guy one-off gag. There was a reason behind it. And yes, it was comical and kind of stupid. You know, it's like, oh, you got it. It's a porn virus. Okay. Ha ha ha. But that is something where you'd have to think about that. I always wondered, even as a kid, what would happen if the holodeck got like, in, you know, an advertising, like a Windows web browser virus. And they kind of, I'll bet you that's the kind of thing where Seth was like, he had been thinking about that probably too for like 20 years. What would happen if that happened?
And when I first watched that episode, I honestly thought that there'd start being pop-ups on all the control panels in the bridge,
which would have been hilarious.
Yeah.
And that would have been funny. Yeah.
Well, that, and I love that the one guy on the ship where he gets the porn from, he's like, also tries to sell him drugs. He's like, no, I'm okay, man. just the porn. So that's kind of fun. I never thought that you could get Norm MacDonald to be on a Star Trek show and have him be one of the more interesting characters.
Well, yeah, because he's just a big gelatinous blob.
Yeah, who is his standard Norm MacDonald sarcastic self, but then ends up being one of the most useful people on the crew.
Oh, I know, like being able to jump in the computer system or down the throat of Isaac or
into the tubes, the Jeffries tubes that aren't Jeffries tubes because they're actually small and useful.
Well, I was like, why would they want him on the team? It's like, oh, he can quite literally get where no man can go. You know, it would be very useful to have him on a ship because you can make the ship more airtight with him on there. Also, for kid actors on a TV show, those kids aren't half bad.
No.
Usually you cringe anytime there's kids on TV. These kids aren't half bad.
They're not a Wesley Crusher.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like I said, with the B plots, they're basically doing what if Data ended up having a family on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they handled it pretty well. They've had multiple episodes dealing with the emotional attachment, like is it real, is it not real, does it matter if it's real, the kids, you know, showing how the kids can get attached very quickly because they're not thinking too deeply about it. And then, you know, they're obviously leading into having more issues with them in the future. I thought it was pretty well handled there. You've got your standard Star Trek tropes where, you got your Klingons, you got your this, you got your that, but and that's sort of always going to happen. There's going to be comparisons to any other show that comes out like that.
Yep.
But what gets me is it's just the lighting, the way people move, the way people walk on set, the way the doors move, just the speed at which people move and the camera pans is so Star Trek that it's unnerving.
Oh, no. And even Jonathan Frakes, when he was shooting, they were asking him what the difference was between the Orville and Discovery. And he says, well, the Orville is very much, you know, that style, like what the Next Generation had, and, you know, very TV budgety looking, but a totally different feel and a lot of lighter tone. And Discovery is more feature film, more serious, more dark, more, you know, just a lot more money dumped into it, basically. And
but for all the money they dump into it, it looks worse.
It does.
It does look worse. We were talking about that right before the cast as well.
Yeah,
dark and shiny doesn't mean good.
Well, their equivalent of the Federation versus the Borg battle they had in season two had special effects that looked better than what we thought was a crazy battle in Discovery season two, because you can make out everything that's happening on screen. It's not all like little specks of things flying around.
Well, the funny thing was, is I watched The Best of Both Worlds part one and two, and then I watched First Contact, and then I watched all of the Dominion War huge battles, and you have a multitude of different starships of various configurations clearly seen either in various states of zipping by on the screen or blowing up, and they did it with, you know, pretty much practical effects. I mean, having a lot of that stuff there. I mean, it wasn't
a small percentage of the budget.
Yeah.
And it's insane that they were doing
very primitive digital or analog in tape manipulation, that sort of stuff, or putting cells on top of it, you know, very creative ways of doing
awesome.
It. And then how they do it in Discovery, it's like, oh, there's a lot of things happening on screen, but you know what? They're just copied and pasted the exact same asset, so it doesn't have to render as much.
Oh, I know, and I was sickened by seeing that in Discovery, watching all of those different, even in Picard, they had the same problem. It was
Picard was just literally copied and pasted the exact same ship. Just hey, let's shrink them down to make them look like they're farther away.
I'm pretty sure I ran.
Yeah, I know.
In our Picard review, that
they weren't even. I went back and watched it. They did such a poor job that they didn't even get the perspective right. They quite literally just dragged and dropped the ship to shrink it. They didn't place it farther away in space to make it look farther away. It was like they got the physics right in like Babylon 5 in 1993, 1994, and they couldn't get it right in Picard with 10, 15 times the budget.
None of those Starfleet vessels in that last episode of Picard, they weren't even fully rendered. Like the 3D models were really basic 3D models. They didn't have windows, big chunks of them.
They were very blocky.
They didn't do any ray tracing, any texture mapping. It was almost like a video game from 2005.
There was no Starfleet pennants, no registry numbers, no names, nothing like that.
It was all dark like Discovery.
Don't
there was
be
no
surprised.
Like, none of that bright look.
Yeah. Don't be surprised if when the Blu-ray comes out, if we magically have a re-rendered scene. Because they know that the only people that are going to buy the show are the super fans. And the super fans are pissed.
Pretty much.
Whereas in this one, during that battle, there's a lot of the ships are replicated and copied, but there's a few varieties. There's also a lot of the individual fighter jets that pop up, and then they have the Krill show up. There's enough variety, and it's not just randomized movements from a computer program showing, make the drones look like they're going in all different directions. Every single scene, every single shot had meaning.
Oh, yeah. Which is the tell of a true writer, director, producer.
Yeah.
I'd be very interested to see what the comparison of the storyboards are for Discovery and for the Orville. I'm willing to bet one has a lot more detailed instructions than the other.
Well, the fact that they have a writer's room for any of the Star Trek series, and yet they still can't get basic continuity or information correct or personas or any of that, or can't connect the dots between episode one and whatever episode they end on with character personalities, such as like the whole Seven of Nine scene in the end of Picard, or, you know, the captain and things like that. It speaks volumes of how much effort that they put in. They're like, oh, it's kind of fluid. We just kind of do, you know. Whereas I have a feeling Seth MacFarlane is like, look, this is the guidebook. This is what I want to do. You stay within the parameters with your story and we're good. You know,
it's, yeah, he openly admitted they made a series Bible for the show. And I thought that
I
was
don't
a given.
Feel like any Trek series has.
No, not since Enterprise. Like they, no. If you
yeah,
look,
all the original stuff.
The first episode of The Orville, written by Seth MacFarlane, famously directed by Jon Favreau between Marvel gigs, which, you know, you get a big movie director to do it, sure, but he's also somebody who's had a lot more hits than he's had misses,
so
it doesn't feel like he would have taken up the offer to do it if he didn't think it was going to be good based on the script.
Well, and then we had Robert Duncan McNeil from Voyager, Tom Paris, and then Brandon Braga, the executive producer of the show. And then you have Jonathan Frakes in there too, and
directed by
Brandon Braga keeps doing it.
Other James L. Conway, who had directed episodes of Enterprise, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Next Generation. So you've got those. Let me see other people that directed.
It's season two is pretty much the same people, although there's a few others added in there as well.
Marina Sirtis makes a guest star appearance in season two.
Who does?
Marina Sirtis.
Oh, yeah. So does Robert Picardo, yeah. John Billingsley, Jason Alexander, Patrick Warburton, Bruce Willis, Tim Russ, Tony Todd. I mean, they got a pretty, you know, bang up amount of high profile people in there, not only from Trek, but just in general.
And, you know, if you look at it, the last couple episodes, we talked off air that you weren't a big fan of the Marin. But the episode before that, Sanctuary, was dealing with one of the B plots that had been happening earlier on in the show with the Mocklins saying that they were a single gendered race, when the reality was they were doing forceful genetic surgeries on people. And this was an explosion of that, where you found out, hey, there's you know, an entire resistance group of the female gendered people, and how do they deal with it? Pardon me?
I was okay with that episode.
Yeah, no, I'm saying this, the kind of stuff they're doing on here is not what you're getting in Star Trek at all.
Yeah.
You're not getting the philosophical questions.
No, I feel like with Star Trek, the thing that they're trying to do in the modern Treks are, instead of doing the philosophical episodes like what we used to get in all of the other ones, you know, the moral dilemmas, you know, even like when Sisko was trying to get the Romulans into the Dominion War, and there was that whole episode where he's talking to the camera, recording his log, and recites the kind of dirty hand he had to play in it, and Garak involved. I mean, those type of dilemmas, you don't get anything that rich in any of the new Star Treks. And I feel like with the Orville, you do. And the new Star Treks, it's more or less, let's put something in here because we're trying to make a headline and because we're trying to be woke with it, instead of, does it make sense with the story? You know, yeah, where the Orville and Star Trek, even the old Star Trek, it still touches on things that are still relevant today.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. They're chasing the 10-second, the 24-hour headline. Like 10 seconds of fame for 24 hours on, you know, a news website, whereas they should be chasing the audience, and they're not.
And if they chase the audience, it's long term.
Yeah, they should be chasing the cultural heritage that Star Trek has always had. This long term, decades long idea that Star Trek is there to make you think, and not to just be pretty explosions on the screen. And let's fill it with 1,000 shuttlecraft pouring out of Enterprise's ass.
Yeah, and think about this too. When it comes to marketing cross media platforms, which show would do better if they made a toy line right now?
The Orville.
Yeah.
Or Orville would. Yeah.
Toys. If they made a video game, if they made a book series, what kids are going to read or want to watch, or what parents are going to let their kids watch Star Trek. There's never been a time where my parents, when I was a kid, would have said, you know, you can't watch Star Trek. They would say, oh, you're watching that Star Trek show again? Why are you watching that? Like, if they thought that I maybe wasn't going to understand it, you know, some of the more complex things, but I still watched it. But I feel like with the new shows, ever since the movies have come out, and they feel like they have to go, you know, it's like the show now has to be 50% Abrams universe movies, 50% Battlestar Galactica, and edgy as all hell. And I feel like my parents wouldn't have let me watch it now if I was 7 or 8 years old, you know, watching this.
And I totally agree with you. My parents would never have let me watch Star Trek if this was the case. Now, the old stuff, yeah, we used to watch it when it was new, coming out on Sunday nights. Like, that was like a every week ritual.
I grew up watching reruns of the original series with my parents. One of my first memories is actually sitting in a drive-through theater watching the motion picture. That tells you my age, right? Like, I remember barely sitting in a drive-through with my parents. Like, I was like 2 and a half or something like that, but barely remember it, right? I remember watching all those Next Gen episodes and Deep Space Nine with my parents, and then when I moved out, you know, I was still watching Voyager. I'll be honest, I do foster care. I have a foster kid with me in my house right now. I would not let her watch Picard. Just because of
Discovery.
Very specific. Discovery, you can maybe get why if the kids are older, but Picard has a certain level of cruelty in some episodes where it's the kind of thing you would have expected in a spinoff show, where the spinoff show was made, you know, mature audiences only.
Yeah, I could not let her watch Picard because there's, you know, there's the torture scene in it with Icheb. You know, things like that, where there's no way that this would have ever happened in Star Trek growing up, that this is not something that should be there for a thoughtful TV show that will bring the family together and then have everyone think and talk about it afterwards. You know, hey, this is not the same show that had Laxana Troy crying about a person that she had just met, wanting to go back to his planet and die because he just turned 60. And then he's decided to stay, but his planet refuses to understand, you know, that episode of Next Gen where you're thinking about, wow, this is an allegory to assisted suicide. And I mean, it's a deep episode, man. I just watched that today and I cried. Like, it's a deep episode, but nah, we're just going to pull people's eyes out and torture them and then have...
For no reason. If they had built an entire season up where things are going, and then in the you know, season finale, the cliffhanger is they're captured and this happens at the end, and you're like, oh my God, you might go, okay, it's been building to it, you've built it, but there was no connection other than we're going to sadistically murder any character you liked from the past.
So in a roundabout way, what I'm trying to say is thank you, Seth MacFarlane, for giving me Star Trek that I can actually watch with a kid and feel comfortable enough to not have to be constantly on the stop button waiting for something awful to happen that might trigger trauma or something like that.
And the sex jokes and crass, the whatever humor and sex jokes that are in there are nothing worse than what you see in a regular sitcom now. So it's not like it's over the top. Like they don't go way more like, the most they go where it's like, oh, maybe some kids wouldn't get it or shouldn't, or you might not want to watch with your kids is when was it Rob Lowe's character?
Yeah.
When he walks in on him and he basically blows a load on himself of his own, whatever goo he has. And you're like, ew, that's gross. And kids might not get it, or you might not feel comfortable with them. But other than that, there's like, it's like one joke in the entire thing. Every bit of Star Trek has been, oh, that's not okay.
Well, and this is the funny thing, and is Discovery and the Orville came out around the same time. And we were talking about this off air too. The average tomato, like the Rotten Tomatoes. Now, granted, I don't put any weight into this because I just watch shows. I don't really care what they have to say. But I still find it funny when things line up a certain way. Discovery, now mind you, when it came out originally, it had about a 90-something percent average tomato reader, you know, fresh reader.
It was 100% when the first episode premiered.
Yeah, and the average audience score is 42% now, and it's the you know, whether they enjoyed it, the critic tomato meter is at 83% now. The funny thing is looking at the Orville, The average tomato meter, which that was like 12 or 14% or something.
It was the low. They announced it was the lowest Fox review for a premiere ever.
Yeah, and it's 65% now, which is probably because of season two. But the average audience score is 94%, which still beats Discovery, and it beats Picard, because Picard has an 87% tomato meter fresh and 58% average audience score, which just goes to show you that Seth MacFarlane is doing something right with the Orville.
I'm shocked.
He's got the finger on the pulse of what people want, and it felt like people were claiming, oh, that reviewers were paid to review bomb or praise. There might be some of that. There might be some tampering, but it really started to show that there's a big disconnect in between. You know, I'm wondering if there's an issue with, like, if every reviewer that received a pre-screening of it or press screenings, if they're all reviewing it the same way, you're not having enough diversity in your, like, in the entire media pool. Obviously, if everybody's thinking the same way and they're writing the exact same thing, but the audience is disconnected, then there's a problem. You're not having people working in the media that are representing the people.
I'm shocked that the Picard audience score is that high. I mean, I know that there are people out there that like it, but it's not anywhere close to that.
I'm thinking most of those reviewers are skewing young. I mean, younger than us that work for these sites now. A lot of traditional journalists are gone. So I'm wondering if that's a factor. Like, they're thinking it's cool, but they never grew up watching it.
Which could be the case. The funny thing is the Picard. I enjoyed Picard for what it was, in a sense, like, because it's continuing. But I was not happy with the product that we got out of it. Whereas Discovery season one, I absolutely loathed season one, and I was like, well, I'll give season two a shot because they introduced the Enterprise and Pike at the end of the season finale, and I was like, well, we haven't seen him, and I was curious, and I wanted to see how that turned out. And then I was happy about season two of Discovery because it had Pike in it, and that was literally the only reason I watched the show.
Well, here, if you look at season one of the Orville, currently has a 31% tomato meter.
Yeah.
Season two has 100%. And you're telling me that at the time, everybody that reviewed the first three episodes, because that was what was available, were saying that the show was doomed, that it was terrible, and it should be taken off the air. These exact same people, season two, are now giving it 100%. So nothing's really changed. They toned down some of the comedy that was probably being forced upon them by Fox initially, but they didn't dramatically change tone.
Season two is different,
but it's better.
Yeah, it's better. It's better. It is different than season one. Season one is way more humor. Like you said, they probably were able to tone it down from what Fox wanted, but it is different, and it's different in a good way.
But I've noticed that whatever happened to accountability, though, you'd think the reviewers would go back and you know, make a statement saying, I've read some of the reviews for season two. They make no mention that they didn't like season one at all. It's just
here's the funny thing. The top critics for the Orville overall give it a 15% rotten. And when they add the other critics, it gets up to 65% for the average. Which I find funny, to be honest.
I'll say this too. The music is better in the show than pretty much anything else on TV right now.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I received, I have season one soundtrack on CD. And if you popped it in, you would immediately go, is that Star Trek? Or you go, oh, no, wait, that's Stargate. And you'd be like, no, that's neither. But it sounds like both. So they've done a good job there. The sound design. I'm waiting. I want them to put out the show on like, it's got a DVD release for season one, but no Blu-ray for season one or two at all. Wait, who puts out a DVD of a show but no Blu-ray in this day and age? Like, so if you get it on DVD, it's lower quality than watching it streaming.
Wow.
So thanks. Fox. Yeah, thanks, Fox. yet they'll put out like the seventh edition of Firefly
or, over and or over Star and over Wars. Again.
And it's like, Firefly, I get that's a great show, but I bought it when it was $70 on Blu-ray. Now you every like year there's like, here's a new Firefly edition for $10. Why don't you put out the shows that people are currently watching?
I think it's funny that the Orville has a 75-piece orchestra for the music, which is very reminiscent of the original Star Treks.
Thank you, Seth MacFarlane. I will say that again.
Yes, exactly. And I'm very interested in seeing where season 3 goes because of the freedom. I don't think he's going to, you know, do too much to screw it up. I don't know if he wants to go. I think the fear is that he might go truly serialized, and that's going to be bad for them. They need to keep this, you know, not Monster of the Week, you know, have an A plot that's different every week and have a B plot that runs through.
Yeah,
that's what has always worked for long form sci-fi shows.
Well, it's worked for all the Star Trek shows, and there's rumors that the Strange New Worlds is going to take that effect too.
I'd hope if they're going to, I'd hope so, because, you know, look at any of the shows that have run in like genre television longer than a couple seasons. You got your Star Treks, you've got like, well, Babylon 5 doesn't count because that was 5 seasons written out before it started. But you've got your Star Treks, you've got your Stargates, you've even got like Supernatural. Any of those kind of shows where they get like, you know, 10, 15 seasons in some cases, they're smart. They have Monster of the Week and then a, you know, a B and C plot that run throughout the season. That's how you get people hooked. And it feels like everybody after Battlestar Galactica came out went, well, no, we could just make it one long arc. Yeah, but you have to, like, you forget that half the people that wrote, you know, half the people that wrote Battlestar were people that left Deep Space Nine. And, you know, it was Ron Moore assembled the writer's room and went, let's just sort of continue what we were doing with the last few seasons of Deep Space Nine and make a completely serialized show. And that was cool. But then everybody went, let's copy that, because it got a lot of press. They went to the UN. They did speeches. They were considered one of the best TV shows of the last 20 years. And it's like everybody, including Star Trek, tries to copy that model. And it's like, for binge-worthy TV, in quotes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, I don't have to have a serialized show to binge watch. I can have a bunch of random episodes because, you know what? I will watch more episodes of The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits than I will of current Star Trek. Why? Because I can pick an episode at random anytime I want and get a completely different story.
And that's what I do with the old Star Trek shows.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to watch the old Star Trek shows over the new ones just because I don't want to be depressed all the time.
Exactly. That's what
I want to watch with people's eyes getting ripped out.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the things that stroke the mental part of my brain that I don't have to. I mean, it's a philosophical thing where I get to think about it, but I also don't necessarily have to fully pay attention either, because it's touching on, you know, basic human concepts. Like, it's not
like it's like Isaac is having to basically go camping with the boys, those sorts of episodes, because they can tell a larger part of the story while you can go, these are some of the beats they're going to touch on, but we're going to get some character growth throughout this.
Oh yeah, totally.
And then every once in a while you have a fun, you know, multi-part episode where a bunch of aliens want to destroy the whole human race and you got to stop them, which is always great. But yeah, it feels like what modern sci-fi is doing nowadays is, one, they're either doing it really cheap, which is garbage, but when they're making their shows, they're taking, for instance, the 2 to 3 episodes of the AI race trying to kill all biotics, and they're going, those 3 episodes, let's stretch that out to 12. And that's the whole show. And you're like, oh God. And then they got to fill it with crap. When it's like, no, that's like set up in one episode. And then they have a two-parter later on that does the whole thing. And then they'll leave a thread for later on. Like that's how traditional TV was written. Like, I don't know what happened. Like, is it that writers are not learning how to write television anymore? Like, are they just not learning from anybody?
I cannot believe that that's the case. I can't, because it doesn't take a lot of effort to write. I'm not saying that it's easy to write television. What I'm saying is that it's easy to write all your ideas down on a piece of paper to say A leads to B leads to C leads to D. Now let's write some good dialogue. Let's write some good stage direction. And yeah, you need some help with that. That's great. That's what a writer's room is for. So I cannot believe that writers in general, because, hey, have I ever written for television? Of course not. I haven't, but I've written for Star Trek. I know what to do, right? It's not like it's rocket science.
Then it's got to be, you got a few bad eggs, you know, in charge that are hiring their cronies that just don't know what they're doing.
The problem is on the production side. Yeah,
like you got executive producers and showrunners that are hiring the wrong people, and then hiring yes men and women that are like, yeah. They don't have any independent thought, and they're presenting their thoughts being shot down, and then because for self preservation, they're not just saying, screw this, I'm leaving the show. Because I feel like some of the stuff that's happened on Star Trek in the last 3 years, had you had any of the writers' rooms on, you know, from the 90s or even early 2000s in there working, and then somebody from high up said, this is what you were doing this season, you would have had an exodus of people. They wouldn't have just been like, fine, I'll get money writing something else. And it just feels like, that's why I'm always so mad at the Kurtzman and anybody that comes from the bad robot school of terrible, terrible production.
It's all production side.
And if I met them in person, I'm not afraid. I would say, you know, you're terrible at making television. You make money, but you don't make compelling television. So I know it's kind of been hijacked. I know we're talking a lot about Star Trek because it's so intertwined. You can't talk about the Orville without talking about Star Trek. Here's the thing. Would you guys like the show more or less if Star Trek had not come back and this is just what came out by itself independently?
I'd like it more. I'd like Orville far more.
Yeah, totally.
Now, would you have... If this came out, you know, let's say we had those movies, the Star Trek movies, and then they were like, we're done, we're not making any television, and then the Orville comes out, would you not have gone, man, I wish Star Trek would come back because they could do this without the comedy?
I would also say that. I would say, man, I wish Star Trek would come back because they could have done something like this.
And then, like, interestingly enough, what if this had come out, season one, and then we got season one of Discovery while season two of this was airing? What would you have said then?
Season one of Discovery probably wouldn't have been made the way it was.
Exactly. I'm almost mad that this didn't come out earlier.
I wish it would have. It might have saved us all a lot of pain.
Like if this had come out circa 2015, like, and we were in like season four now, you know, let's say they took a bit of a break between certain seasons, it would have been amazing. Although I don't think it would have lasted. I feel like it can only have come out during this big explosion of streaming networks, because, you know, Fox would have canceled this anyway after season two, because it wasn't like they expect every one of their shows to get 15 million viewers like they could get 25 years ago, even though realistically regular broadcast TV numbers are never going to be anywhere near that anymore.
No.
Unless you put on, you know, Young Sheldon or some other direct garbage that bottom feeders can watch. And yes, I don't care if somebody gets mad at me for saying that. They're the dumbest shows on the planet.
Well, I stopped watching that show. I can't even spit out the name right now of the original show. Not Young Sheldon.
Big Bang Theory? Everybody point and laugh when we press a button to make people laugh?
Yeah, it was mean-spirited. It was making fun of geek culture rather than with geek culture. See, I put two shows side by side, Big Bang Theory and then Community. Community is laughing along with...
Yeah, and it required a little more... Here's the thing. Big Bang Theory requires zero knowledge of the culture to laugh, because the laugh track tells you when to laugh.
Yeah.
And then not only does the laugh track tell you when to laugh, it's... let's laugh at the at someone who is on the autism spectrum because they're different. That's yeah, the whole spirit. Joke. And even his friends are, let's make fun of our friend. He's brilliant, but let's make fun of him because he's doesn't think like normal people think. And it's like that, you know, you when the season first started, the first couple seasons, it was even more overt that way. And then it just became your standard 80s garbage. Let's have a bunch of catchphrases that we'll just press a button and do a laugh track to. I was surprised when they zoomed out and showed that there's actual live crowds there. And I'm thinking, do they pick the live crowds from, you know, whoever has the lowest IQ in the room, they get to go into the room and watch? Because anybody trying to watch that show live, it would be even less funny. Like, and that's the sad thing. And then you watch Community, and I can understand some people, like my parents, like my mom doesn't get a lot of comedy that's more subtle, or like, and she not like she doesn't like laugh track, she hates that stuff anyway, but it's not necessarily her type of comedy, but she could see how it would be funny. My dad's seen that show and loved it, thought it was hilarious. You watch Community, and Community is nerdy comedy written by nerdy people for an intelligent audience where they don't talk down to you. And if they're talking down to you, it's to make fun of other shows that talk down to you.
Yeah. And so tying that back into Orville, Orville's not talking down to you as a viewer. Orville's not trying to make you feel bad about not being quote unquote woke, or not making you feel bad because you think a certain way or don't think a certain way. Orville's just there to have fun and present situations just like old Star Trek did, to make you think and not force something into you.
Yeah, and there's a big difference there too. When you watch Discovery and the current Picard and stuff, the new generation of Star Trek is, we're going to present you with horrible decisions and you're going to automatically make the worst decision possible because it's what's right to you and how you feel in the moment when you're doing it. Whereas whereas the Orville is, here's our moral dilemma. We're going to spend 30 minutes trying to decide what decision we can make, realize that there is no good decision, make the decision we can make based on our moral choices, and probably still get it wrong. Which is, you know, it's teaching you that in life, there are sometimes situations where there's no win, or you have to pick the lesser of two evils, or you pick a bad decision, you have to deal with the consequences. With Discovery, these people make their horrible decisions, and they're rewarded for it. Because, you know, we're pushing this agenda that this character has to always be right, and they're going to always do right, even when it's quite clear that what they're doing is wrong. The entire show is about a war criminal. And people are okay with that?
I'm not, but yeah,
like, you know what I mean? Like she basically starts a war. Well, and they're okay with that. They're okay with that. And it's like, oh, it's because she has PTSD, you know. Yeah, okay. Deal with it. Yeah, actually get help for it.
The show that allows, you know, an emperor from the mirror universe who is clearly also a fascist dictator to just run free around and basic
federation.
Yeah. Or also the whole premise of having their AI go crazy and take over and want to destroy everybody. It's from a time when this isn't like we didn't have Enterprise or there hadn't been anything showing the past or previous time before Kirk, but you're telling me that this giant federation didn't see this happening. You know, they didn't see that they were being taken over. They didn't see
that, like 10 years in the future when Daystrom actually comes up with the multitronic computer in Star Trek, where it actually has a little bit of a personality and it's his personality and it actually ends up, you know, killing a Starfleet crew and all that. That was a big deal. Like, my God, this is such a huge advancement.
Yeah. And like it's a case of writers trying to throw modern sci-fi stuff into a property that they should be thinking of. If we're going to make the show in the past, we have to think like the writers would have thought in the 60s. If the show takes place at the same time as the show from the 60s, the sci-fi tropes need to be the sci-fi tropes from the 60s, because otherwise it doesn't fit with the rest of your canon.
I mean,
well, they'll screw that up in Strange New Worlds.
Oh yeah. which is fine, I guess. I'll watch it because I like watching train wrecks. And
well, when I like Pike, So that's
I mean, I love Pike too. That was the best part of freaking Discovery season two, but they're just going to ruin it.
Yeah. I mean, they're either going to ruin it or one can hope maybe they cancel the show and they give him a movie.
I mean, they could, but I feel like that they would be better off doing a series.
Yeah. I wonder if there's any animosity between CBS and the largely CBS Star Trek production team writers and directors that are working on the Orville. Like, I don't think there's been any issues with Jonathan Frakes because he's jumped back and forth to direct an episode here and there. But I guess because he's sort of untouchable, you can't just not have him in it. But I'm wondering if some of the writers are kind of blackballed from ever going over to do stuff on the Star Trek side, at least until some studio executives change.
I think the writers might not be okay, but I know that they're okay with bringing certain actors as long as they play into the whatever they're trying to tell with Picard.
I'm pretty sure that Brandon Braga is not going to be welcome back at CBS for a while.
Yeah, because that's somebody really high up.
Well, unless they get rid of, or you know, Kurtzman. So
I guess what I think, since we're talking about Star Trek so much, is that Orville is fantastic because it does everything that is Star Trek, that it does everything that Star Trek is not doing anymore. And if you liked Star Trek, go to Orville. You're going to enjoy it. That's the reason why we're bitching about Star Trek now, is because we have something that is Star Trek. It just doesn't have the label.
Yeah. And if you want something that's a little more serious or you know, darker in tone, why don't you just watch The Lost in Space on Netflix? I haven't seen season two yet, but I really enjoyed season one. And that has the tone and look and feel and the production budget that I would have figured they were trying to go for with Discovery.
Season two was pretty good, I thought.
So do you think that we might start seeing some more shows pop up in this similar vein? Like, you've gone, you've gone on and talked about how much you love The Expanse, and that's sort of one extreme. But as far as like the flagship family, sort of family friendly, but not kid, you know, kiddie type show that we get with The Orville, do you think there's going to be more shows that pop up like this, or is this sort of an anomaly in today's age?
I think it's an anomaly. To me, it's an anomaly because I don't see a lot of, I just can't see a lot of shows doing what Orville is doing properly and still trying to hit every demographic that most producers would want.
Because, yeah, there was like a golden era of space sci-fi shows where you had, you know, at least one Star Trek property on the air. You had Farscape on, you had Stargate, you had Andromeda even. What was the other one? Star Hunter was on. You had about 5 to 10 different sci-fi space flavors that were available all within 1999 to 2004. Do you think we're going to hit that again, like where we hit that peak? Because it was all thanks to Star Trek. And
I'm sure that we will at some point. I don't think it's going to be anytime soon.
So do we have any news? Steve, you said on when season three is coming?
Well, they're saying that it's supposed to come this summer. They got, or maybe even this fall, because they got delayed because of COVID. But no, I just had the news that they have more freedom by being on Hulu as opposed to being on standard television.
Yeah, so I mean, fingers crossed that they don't use that as a platform to go way out of bounds. I don't think they will, but I think that they might use it to delve deeper into some of these social issues that they weren't, or they were teetering on the edge of before. I just hope they don't go pandering in one direction or another, and they don't go like too bloody or anything, but it might mean we end up with episodes like, I didn't know until I got the Blu-rays that TNG's Measure of a Man had an original 58-minute cut that, you know, they had to cut down for TV. Back then, they still had, I think it was 46 or 47 minutes is what they used to get on syndicated TV. So that director's cut, you can only get on the Blu-ray. I don't even think it was ever released on the DVD versions. And there's a lot more character pieces and a lot more stuff that really goes into it. And this might provide them the platform where, hey, this episode's 42 minutes because it has a complete story. This episode is, you know, a little more philosophical, so we need 55 minutes. I just hope that that's the kind of route they go with.
Yeah, I agree.
Agreed. So I think that about rounds this episode out of Future Imperfect. So where can the good people get a hold of you if they so choose?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Aaron Pollier on Facebook.
And for me, you can hit me up. I'm basically running everything over at This Week in Geek for me and Michael over there. So it's thisweekingeek.net, the website. Facebook's This Week in Geek. Hit us up on Twitter at This Week in Geek. Feedback at thisweekingeek.net. Any of those, and I'll be able to find you.
And of course, you can get a hold of me on the Twitters at SCP21. So until next time, live long and prosper.